Good afternoon, everyone. And Steve, thank you very much for that introduction. And thank you to you and to CEDA for the invitation to speak to you today. It's a great pleasure for me to be back here in Adelaide and to participate in another CEDA event. CEDA does fantastic work, and I'm very glad to be able to support it. So thank you. Those of you who follow the RBA closely would have noticed frequent references to the labour market in our recent communication. So today I'd like to explain why we've been doing this and also to discuss how we think about spare capacity in the labour market. And then I'll finish with some comments about monetary policy. Those of you who are students of central bank history, and I hope there are at least a few in the room, I would be aware that the Reserve Bank Act was passed by the Australian Parliament in 1959, so that's 60 years ago now. In terms of monetary policy, the Parliament set three broad objectives for the Reserve Bank Board. It required the Board to set monetary policy so as best contribute to one, the stability of the currency, two, the maintenance of full employment, and third, the economic prosperity and welfare of the people of Australia. These objectives have remained unchanged since 1959. Here in Australia, we did not follow the fashion in many other countries over recent decades to set just a single objective for the central bank, that's inflation control. And in my view, it was very sensible not to follow this fashion. Our legislated objectives, having three elements, are broader than the objectives of many other central bank. The third of our three objectives does serve as a constant reminder to us that the ultimate objective of our policies is the collective welfare of the people of Australia, and that's important. From an operational perspective, though, as Steve said, the flexible inflation target is the centrepiece of our monetary policy framework. The target, which has been agreed with successive governments, is to deliver an average rate of inflation over time of 2 to 3%. Our focus is very much on the average and on the medium term. Inflation averaging 2 point something constitutes a reasonable definition of price stability. And achieving this stability helps with achieving our other objectives. Low and stable inflation is a precondition to the attainment of full employment, and it promotes our collective welfare. As I've said on other occasions, we're not targeting inflation because we're some form of inflation nutters. Rather, we're doing so because delivering low and stable inflation is the most effective way for Australia's central bank to promote our collective welfare. So where does the labour market fit into all of this? And the answer is that it's central to all three of our objectives. The connection with the second objective, full employment, is, I hope, obvious. The RBA is seeking to achieve the lowest rate of unemployment that can be sustained without inflation becoming an issue. In doing this, one of the questions we face at the moment is what constitutes full employment in our modern economy where work arrangements are much more flexible than they once were. I'm going to return to this issue in a moment. The labour market is, of course, also central to our third objective, our collective welfare. It's perhaps stating the obvious to say that for many Australians, having a good job at a decent rate of pay is central to their economic prosperity. Trends in the labour market also have a major bearing on inflation outcomes, so they're critical to our first objective. Over time, there's a close link between wages, growth, and inflation, and a critical influence on wage outcomes is the balance between supply and demand in the labour market, or in other words, how much spare capacity is there in the labour market at a given point in time. This question is obviously closely linked to the one about what constitutes full employment. So all this means that it's natural that the board of the RBA to focus heavily on the labour market as it makes its monthly decisions about interest rates, and we've certainly been doing that recently. With that background, I'd like to discuss how we assess the degree of spare capacity in the Australian labour market at the moment. And I want to do this from four perspectives. The first is the rates of unemployment and underemployment. The second is the flexibility of the supply side of the labour market. The third is the effectiveness with which people are matched with job vacancies, and the fourth is trends in wages. So they're the four perspectives I'm going to take. So first to unemployment and underemployment. The conventional measure of spare capacity in the labour market is the gap between the actual unemployment rate and the unemployment rate associated with full employment. As my colleague Lucy Ellis discussed last week, we don't directly observe the unemployment rate associated with full employment, so we need to estimate that. Over recent times, though, there's been a gradual accumulation of evidence to suggest that the estimates are lower than we previously thought. While it's not possible to pin down the number exactly, the evidence is consistent with an estimate below 5%, perhaps around 4.5%. And given that the current unemployment rate is 5.2%, this suggests pretty clearly that there is still spare capacity in our labour market. The fact that the conventional estimate of spare capacity is based on the unemployment rate reflects an implicit assumption that if you have a job, you're pretty much fully employed. Now, in decades past, this might have been a reasonable assumption. But it's not a realistic assumption in today's modern flexible labour market, so we need a broader measure of spare capacity. As more and more of us have worked part-time, it's become increasingly common to be both employed and to work fewer hours than you want to work. As you can see here in my first chart, in the 1960s, less than 1 in 10 workers worked part-time. Today, 1 in 3 of us work part-time. And as you can see in the top line there, almost 1 in 2 women work part-time, and more than 1 in 2 younger workers work part-time. These are big changes. A few more facts are perhaps helpful here. According to the ABS, around 3 million people work part-time because they want to, not because they can't find a full-time job. Most people who are working part-time do so because they're studying or they have caring responsibilities or for other personal reasons. So we shouldn't think of part-time jobs as being bad jobs and full-time jobs as being good jobs. Rather, one of the great successes of the Australian labour market is that we have been able to accommodate this desire for part-time work and greater flexibility. Having said that, around one quarter of people working part-time are not satisfied with the hours that they're working and they'd like to work more hours. And you can think of these people as being underemployed. As is evident in this chart, the share of part-time workers who are underemployed moves up and down from year to year, but the current share is above the average of the past two decades. You can see that in the top panel here. As part of the ABS's monthly survey of 50,000 people, it asks underemployed workers how many extra hours they would like to work. And as you can see in the bottom panel here, on average, these underemployed workers say they would like another 14 hours per week. It's interesting to point out that this figure has trended down over the past two decades. It used to be around 16 hours a week. And over the same time period, the average hours worked by part-time workers has increased by around 2 hours to 17 hours a week. And taken together, these data do suggest that businesses are doing a better job of providing the hours that part-time workers want. This shift to part-time work means that in assessing spare capacity, we need to consider measures of underemployment as well as measures of unemployment. And the RBA has been doing this for some time. As part of our efforts in this area, we've constructed a measure of underutilisation that takes account of part-time workers who want more hours. You can see this measure in this chart. It adds the extra hours sought by these workers to the hours sought by those who are unemployed. These extra hours sought by part-time workers are equivalent to around 3.3% of the labour force, which, taking account of the conventional measure of unemployment, means the underutilisation rate is 8.1%. This hours-based measure of underemployment is preferable to the heads-based measure, which often gets public attention, as the heads-based measure treats an unemployed person in the same way as it treats a part-time person seeking a few more extra hours. As you can see in this chart, unlike the unemployment rate, which has trended down over the past 20 years, the underemployment rate has been pretty stable. And these different patterns in unemployment and underemployment suggest that fewer inroads have been made into spare capacity in the labour market than suggested by looking at the unemployment rate alone. And this is something that we've been thinking about in terms of monetary policy recently. There is, though, one other perspective on underemployment that I'd like to share with you. In the past, when part-time work was not readily available, many people, and that's mostly women, faced the choice of taking full-time employment or no paid employment at all. Many chose to, or had to, stay outside the labour force because working wasn't a realistic option when the only option was full-time work. From the perspective of society as a whole, this was a serious form of underutilisation. It just wasn't measured as such by the ABS. Today, people do have more options than they had before, and many people are choosing to join or to defer leaving the labour force because they have the flexible options. From the perspective of adding to the productive capacity of the nation, this is a really good outcome. And if there were a measure of underutilisation that took account of exclusion from the workforce, it surely would have declined over recent decades. I don't want to downplay the issue of underemployment because it's a serious issue, but it is worth recognising the broader perspective and remembering where we've come from. This naturally brings me to my second window into spare capacity in the labour market, and that's the flexibility of labour supply. Over the past 2.5 years, the working age population in Australia has increased at an annual rate of around 1.75%. Over that same time period, employment has increased at an average rate of 2.75%. It's quite a gap. The fact that the unemployment rate, the fact that employment has been growing considerably faster than the working age population has led to a reduction in the unemployment rate, as you would expect. But the reduction is not as large as we might have expected. And the reason for this is that the supply of labour has increased in response to stronger demand for workers. This flexibility in labour supply is evident in this next chart, which shows the substantial rise in labour force participation. Right today, the participation rate is 66%, which is the highest it's ever been. Reflecting this, the share of the working age population in Australia with a job is around the record high that was reached at the peak of the resources boom. This is a significant achievement. As I discussed a few moments ago, the availability of part-time and flexible work is one reason for this. There are two groups for which the rise in participation has been particularly pronounced, and they are women and older Australians. So you can see in this next chart, the female participation rate has risen substantially. Female participation now stands at around 61%. That's up from 43% in the late 1970s. Australia's female participation rate is now above the average of the OECD, although it remains below that in a number of countries, including Canada and the Netherlands. The participation rate of older workers has also increased over recent decades as health outcomes have improved and changes have been made to retirement incomes policies. And these changes are contributing to higher participation of older workers. Another source of potential labour supply is net overseas migration. As is evident here, migration, including temporary skilled workers, increased sharply during the resources boom when demand for skilled workers was very strong, and it subsequently declined. While migrants add to both demand and supply in the economy, they can be a particularly important source of capacity and resolving pinch points when the economy is operating at a high level and there is a shortage of particular skills. The ability to tap into overseas workers can be particularly important in adding to supply. A related source of flexibility stems from our unique relationship with New Zealand. When labour demand in Australia is relatively strong, there tends to be an increase in the net inflow of workers from New Zealand, and when conditions here are weak, the reverse is true. During the resources boom, the inflow of workers across the Tasman was as important as the inflow of temporary skilled workers from the rest of the world. But the overall picture here is one of flexibility on the supply side of the labour market. When the demand for labour is strong, more people enter the market and other people delay leaving. And the rise in participation is a very positive development. But it is one of the factors that has meant that strong demand for labour has not put much upward pressure on wages over recent times, and I'll come back to that in a moment. A third perspective on spare capacity can be gained by examining how well people looking for jobs are matched with the jobs that are available. Looking at the labour market from this perspective, things look a little tighter than suggested by the other two perspectives that I've just spoken about. Currently almost 60% of firms report that the availability of labour is either a minor or major constraint on their businesses. As you can see here, this share is not as high as it was during the resources boom, but it is still quite high. Reports from the RBA's liaison program suggest there are currently shortages of certain types of engineers, workers with specialised IT skills, and some tradespeople associated with public infrastructure work. And businesses in regional areas are also more likely to report to us that they have difficulty in finding suitable labour. One contributing factor here is the underinvestment in staff training. In the shadow of the global financial crisis, many firms did cut back training in an effort to save costs. I think we're now seeing the evidence of some of the longer-term adverse effects of that. As the labour market tightens, I would hope we'd see more firms prepared to hire workers and provide the necessary training. Another lens on job matching is the ratio of the number of unemployed people to the number of job vacancies. As you can see in this chart, at present there are fewer than 3 unemployed people for each job vacancy in Australia. This compares with over 20 people for each job vacancy in the early 1990s recession and 5 people for every vacancy in 2014. So from this perspective, the labour market does look reasonably tight. There's also some tentative evidence that on average, unemployed workers are not as well matched to job vacancies as they were a decade ago when the ratio of the two was similar to what it is now. One such piece of evidence is that as the unemployment rate has come down over recent years, there has been little progress on reducing very long-term unemployment, defined as those who are unemployed for more than 2 years. And you can see that here. Now, addressing the causes of this chronic unemployment remains a very important challenge for our community. More positively, as you can see in this chart, the share of the labour force that's been unemployed between 1 and 2 years has trended down over recent times, and that's a positive development. A final lens on job matching and the overall tightness of the labour market is the rate of job mobility. That's how often people are changing their jobs. And here the evidence is quite interesting. Despite the frequent reports of lack of job security and the regular job switching by millennials, the average time that workers are staying with an employer is increasing. Reflecting this, the share of employed people who switch employers in a given year is the lowest it's been in many years. Looking at the data by occupation, the rate of job mobility is lowest for managers and business professionals and highest for tradespeople and workers in the hospitality industry. In a tight labour market, we would expect to see either strong wages growth or frequent job changing as businesses seek out workers. But at the moment, we're seeing neither of these things. One possible explanation for this is the uncertainty that many people feel about the future. This uncertainty means that if you have a job, you want to keep it rather than take a risk with a new employer. And this might be especially so if you have a large mortgage. So it's quite possible that the high level of household debt is affecting our labour market dynamics. I want to now turn to the fourth perspective on labour market tightness, and that's wages growth. Over the past year, wages growth has picked up as the labour market tightened, and that's not surprising given the strength of labour demand. But as you can see here, the pickup has been fairly modest, and it's only evident in the private sector. Over the past year, the private sector wage price index increased by 2.4%, and that's up from 1.9% the previous year. The past two quarters have, however, seen lower wage increases than in the previous two quarters, and I would not like to see this pattern continue. In contrast to trends in the private sector, wages growth in the public sector has been steady at around 2.5%, as you can see. This largely reflects the various public sector wage caps. It's also worth pointing out that overall wage growth in New South Wales and Victoria has been running at just 2.5%, despite the unemployment rate in those states being a bit below 4.5% on average over the past year. Another perspective on wages growth is from the National Accounts, which reports average earnings per hour worked. As is evident here, this measure is quite volatile. But the latest data again pointed a fairly weak picture, with average hourly earnings in Australia increasing by just 1% over the past year. That's a very soft outcome. In summary, the overall picture from these various windows into the labour market is that despite the strong employment growth over recent times, there is still considerable spare capacity in the labour market. We remain short of the unemployment rate associated with full employment. There's significant underemployment, and there's further potential for labour force participation to rise when the jobs are there. And consistent with all this, wages growth remains modest, and it's below the rate that would ensure that inflation is comfortably within the 2 to 3% target range. The one caveat to this assessment is the difficulty that some firms are having finding workers with the necessary skills, and to my mind, this underlines the importance of workplace training. I would like to finish now with a few words on monetary policy. As you're aware, the Reserve Bank Board reduced the cash rate to 1.25% at its meeting earlier this month, and this adjustment was the first one in nearly 3 years. This decision was not in response to a deterioration in the economic outlook since the previous update we published in early May. Rather, it reflected a judgment that we could do better than the path that we look to be on. The analysis that I've shared with you today supports the conclusion that the Australian economy can sustain a higher rate of employment growth and a lower unemployment rate than previously thought likely. Most indicators suggest that there is still a fair degree of spare capacity in the economy. It's both possible and desirable to reduce that spare capacity. Doing so will see more people in jobs, reduce underemployment, and boost household incomes. It will also provide greater confidence that inflation will increase to be comfortably within the medium-term target range. Monetary policy, of course, is one way of helping us get onto this better path. The decision earlier this month will assist us here. It will support the economy through its effect on the exchange rate by lowering the cost of finance and by boosting disposable incomes. In turn, this will support employment growth and inflation consistent with the target. It would, however, be unrealistic to expect that lowering interest rates by just 0.25% will materially shift the path that we look to be on. The most recent data, including the GDP and labour market data, do not suggest we are making any inroads into the economy's spare capacity. Given this, the possibility of lower interest rates remains on the table. It's not unrealistic to expect a further reduction in the cash rate as the board seeks to wind back spare capacity in the economy and to deliver inflation outcomes in line with the medium-term target. It's important, though, to recognise that monetary policy is not the only option, and there are limitations to what can be achieved. As a country, we should also be looking at other ways of getting closer to full employment. One option is fiscal policy, including through spending on infrastructure. Another is structural policies that support firms expanding, investing, innovating, and employing people. Both of these options need to be kept in mind as the various arms of public policy seek to maximise the economic prosperity of the people of Australia. So thank you very much for listening, and I look forward to answering your questions after lunch. Thank you.
Well, sorry to interrupt what has obviously been an engaging conversation over lunch, but we're going to get the Governor, put him in the hot seat to answer all sorts of questions. As is the usual course of things at CEDA, if you'd like to ask a question, please raise your hand and one of the CEDA team will bring a microphone over to you. And if you can introduce yourself and explain where you're from, that would be great. And we will be taking questions from tables and the media. Normally I get to ask the first question, but my gosh, the hands are up everywhere. So I'm going to go straight to the audience. Ember.
Governor Lowe, thank you for your important talk, highlighting the need for unemployment to be reduced. Two things struck me in your talk. Firstly, when you were showing the chart of part-time jobs lifting from 10% to 30% over the past 50 years, I think it was, you argued that it was wrong to think part-time jobs are bad and full-time jobs are good. It's always struck me that it'd be a good mix to have a part-time job where you got paid full-time. So that should be an objective for all of us here. It's just hard to organise. The second thing that struck me was how explicitly you suggested the Reserve Bank's going to cut interest rates further. I understand the board is meeting in Darwin for the first time in a fortnight. Would it be fair to... I've got two questions. One is, would it be fair to say that the board has a red-hot bias to cut rates before it flies south again? And secondly, where does all this rate cutting end? Is there an effective lower bound in Australia? You know, is it 1%? Is it 0.5%? Is it zero? Is it negative as in some other countries? I think a few years ago you hinted the idea that it might be one-ish, but I wonder if you could also update us on your thinking about if there was a sort of a very pessimistic sort of run for the economy over, you know, sometime down the track, how low could interest rates go in Australia before you turn to the more unconventional measures for policy? Thank you.
You asked whether it was fair to characterise the board as having kind of a red-hot bias to cut rates. I wouldn't put it that way. But as I said, we need to be on a better path than we're on. And we've made a start to getting us on a better path. A cut of 0.25% in interest rates is helping. But realistically, it by itself is not going to be enough. So as I said in my remarks, it's reasonable to expect a further cut in interest rates at some point. Whether it'll be in Darwin or at some other point, we'll have to wait and see. What's the effect of lower bound? It's hard to tell, but if you look at the Bank of England, the Bank of Canada and the Federal Reserve, they got to interest rates of 0.5% or 0.25%. And they did unconventional things around that level and a bit before that. So we've seen in Europe, though, the Swiss National Bank have an interest rate of -0.75%. And the ECB is at -40 basis points, and the Swedish Central Bank is at, you know, that level as well. So it's technically possible, and I'm very hopeful that we will not need to go certainly to negative territory and all of these the very other low interest rates that the Federal Reserve and the Bank of Canada got to. And if I can, one reason that I say that is because I think the central scenario for the Australian economy still remains quite reasonable. We'll update our forecast in the next month or so, but the central scenario is reasonable. We're expecting household income growth to pick up, not just because of our interest rate cuts, but because of the government handing back some of its tax revenue. There's a lot of infrastructure investment taking place. The terms of trade are rising again. Resource sector investment is going to be positive next year after being negative for 5 years in a row. And the housing market adjustment hopefully is coming to an end as well. So I think the central scenario for the Australian economy is quite reasonable. If it turns out to be weaker than expected, we still have capacity to lower interest rates by amount. And as I said in my prepared remarks, the response is not just a monetary one. Mm. Fiscal policy and structural policies have a role to play. So I'm hopeful, and I think it's realistic, to expect us to be able to keep away from these very low rates and unconventional measures.
Governor, you talked about, just while we're waiting for the microphone, you talked a lot in your statement about where unemployment is and for those of us who are economists nerds, the national non-accelerating rate of unemployment is what we used to all talk about in our textbooks. I don't think anyone thought it would be as low as it is. And to see interest rates as low as they are and we're still struggling for wage inflation, what do you think? It looks to me like it's something more structural has gone on. To see interest rates where they are, wages growth where it is, I accept your point that we still have spare capacity, but it feels like something else has gone on. Have you got any thoughts about that?
Yeah, I think that's the perspective I share as well. There's one reason wage growth is weak is because there's still spare capacity in the economy, and I think that's probably at least half the explanation. But the other half is structural. And the structural thing that I see is increased perceptions of competition. Everyone feels like there's more competition out there. And one of the first things I learned in high school economics is when there's more competition, prices are lower. Why do we all feel like there's more competition? I think it's globalisation and technology. What does globalisation do? It widens the market, increases the range of competitors. So we all know, all workers know, there's someone else in the world who can do their job maybe at a lower rate of pay, and we all feel that. That's affecting our bargaining position. Firms know that as well, that there are other firms somewhere else in the world that could do their business. So firms are very reluctant to put up their prices, so they want to keep their costs under control, so they don't want to give wage increases, and workers are nervous, and they feel like there's more competition. So this structural sense that competition has increased because of globalisation and technology. I think it's affecting both the price and wage dynamics in Australia and actually right around the world, and it's the primary reason the inflation's low everywhere, this perception of competition. And I don't think it's going to go away anytime soon. It's something we're going to have to get used to.
Okay, I'll try again. Governor, your rate cut this month doesn't seem to have had an immediate impact on consumer confidence. It was stable or fell a little bit. And there's been talk since then that if you were to go back-to-back with rate cuts, with consecutive monthly ones, that might actually end up spooking households about the state of the economy, which obviously you're not as concerned as that, you know, that might imply. I mean, worries about spooking them with consecutive rate cuts, is that something that you'd factor into your thinking when you're deliberating on policy? And a quick second one, on the record participation in the labour market, is part of that perhaps households just not being able to make ends meet and more people are having to enter the labour market just to be able to meet their commitments? Thanks.
The effect of interest rates on cuts on consumer confidence is something we think about quite a lot, not necessarily in the context of whether consecutive rate cuts make sense or not. The message that we've had in the past few weeks is that we're not cutting rates because the economy is getting worse. We've cut rates and we'll probably cut them again because we want the economy to be better, not that it's getting worse. We can deal with a lower rate of unemployment. We should aspire to a lower rate of unemployment, and stronger employment growth, and lower interest. And I hope some measures out of Canberra will eventually help that. So I'm hoping that message gets through to the community. We're not cutting because things are getting worse. We're cutting because we want things to be better. And your point about question about participation, it's probably the case that participation is partly rising because of people's low income growth. Households are feeling that their wages are not rising at the rate they used to, and people are staying in the labour force longer, or maybe your spouse starts working part-time because the household income isn't growing at the rate that people wanted to. So I think that's part of the story, but the more fundamental story is that our labour market has generated part-time jobs and flexibility, because that's what people want. Three-quarters of the people who work part-time do so because they want to and they're happy with the hours they want. Now, there's a perception that all part-time workers are unhappy, but when the ABS asks, are you happy with the hours that you work? Three-quarters of part-time workers say, yes, I'm happy. And I'm doing this because I'm studying, I've got to care for my elderly parents or my children, or I want to play golf. So these are the reasons that people are kind of saying that they want to work part-time. So the ability to do that is kind of fantastic. It's drawn more people into the labour force, and certainly, as I said in my prepared remarks, that there are a group of people who want more hours, and we need to address that. But we shouldn't think of all part-time work as being unsatisfactory. In fact, the bulk of it is what people want to do.
Anyone who's had a conversation with an Uber driver has probably heard that as well. It's the continual refrain from all of them that I speak with. Question over here, thank you.
Thank you. My name's Paul Madden from the Wyatt Trust, which is a philanthropic trust. I guess looking at the graph that reflected the difficulty in movement in long-term unemployment, it set us thinking about with the initiatives for interest rate cuts and infrastructure spending to stimulate the economy further. What's your view in relation to income support payments and the role that they've got in putting money quickly back into the economy, in reducing poverty, in kind of stimulating growth and spending in regional areas where there are traditionally high levels of unemployment?
I take it you're really asking mainly about the New Start allowance and the case for that to be increased. I don't really want to comment on the specifics of that, but the household income growth is weak, and we need it to be stronger. It used to be that household income growth was 5.5% or 6% a year. In recent years, it's been 2.5% or 3%. So it's very low, and that's one reason people aren't spending and the economy softened, because people, unfortunately, having to get used to slower income growth than they experienced in the past. So anything at the moment that can boost income growth, I think, is good for the economy. Yeah. So the interest rate cuts will boost household disposable income because people pay a lot of interest. And I hope the tax rebates get through the Parliament, and that will boost income and perhaps in time stronger support payments for unemployed people will help as well, but that's up to the government.
I was struck by the growth in long-term unemployment as well, and anyone who's had a look at, who understands how difficult it is to get back into employment when you've been out of the workforce for more than 6 months, much less 12 months. But that requires more. That requires structural policies to address that, but it does raise the question about New Start in my mind as well, and the Access Deloitte economics work shows pretty clearly what the multiplier effects are. So if we're looking for a boost in economic growth, you'd like to think it's something that's on the agenda. Now, I've got two people waving. Clint was... Oh, here, thank you.
Governor Simon Evans, I'm with the Financial Review. It sounds as though another rate cut very soon is an absolute, or an almost certainty. When you do that, if the big banks only pass through partial what you're giving, does that mean that you are more likely to then go to unconventional measures like quantitative easing?
The first point is, in my business, nothing's a certainty. I deal with probabilities and scenarios.
They're finding different ways of asking whether the board's red hot to cut again.
I've been pretty clear that you could expect there's a high probability that interest rates will be cut again, whether that occurs in our historic meeting in Darwin or at a meeting back in Martin Place, I don't know. The point about incomplete pass-through of our cash rate decisions in a mortgage rate, does that increase the probability of unconventional monetary policy? The answer to that is no. Because we're really talking, if there's incomplete pass-through, we're talking about maybe 5 or 10 basis points that isn't passed through. Not that I'm endorsing that to occur, but so that is not by itself wouldn't be enough to trip us over into unconventional policies. And as I said in response to the first question, I think it remains quite unlikely we're going to have to go down that route. The central scenario for the economy is quite good. We can reduce our cash rate further, and there are other policy options coming from Canberra and the States as well. So I think it's quite unlikely. And if mortgage rates don't move down 5 basis points because of incomplete pass-through, that isn't enough to trip us over into unconventional things.
Question over here.
Luigi Falivani, KPMG. To follow Keynesian theory of marginal utility, do you believe that every cut that you take has less impact on the economy?
Not every cut becomes less effective than the one before, but I do think cuts in interest rates are less effective than they would have been in years past. And one reason I say that is that in years past, when we cut interest rates, many people would race off to the bank and seek to borrow more. either to spend on consumption or to buy another property or buy a car. Today, people are much less inclined to do that. We've all, as a society, got kind of a lot of debt. Many of us feel like we've got too much debt. So when interest rates come down, the first thing we think of isn't to run off to the bank and go and borrow more. It's to try and pay down our debt more quickly. So that means that cuts in interest rates don't have the same effect that they used to. It doesn't mean they become ineffective, because we still have an effect on the exchange rate, and we've seen that in the past few weeks. Lower interest rates do increase the free cash flow of the household sector, and some of that will be spent. And lower interest rates also tend to push up asset prices. I think we're seeing some of that globally in the last week as well, not just because of what we've done, but what other central banks are saying. And higher asset prices tend to stimulate more spending. So I'm confident that lower interest rates still stimulate the economy, create jobs and push inflation up, but realistically they don't have quite the same effect that they used to.
Thank you. Yes, Governor Lowe. Jackie McGill, Chair of TAFE South Australia. My question relates to your comments that the increased globalisation of employees, potentially, and markets is indicating that the current activities that you monitor are less effective. So if they're changing, you're seeing a trend. So do the things you monitor within the Reserve Bank need to reflect that increased globalisation? And if so, what would they be?
Well, we monitor the global economy incredibly carefully, as you would imagine, and we try and understand the forces that are operating globally to give low wage growth and low inflation, because it's not just an issue in Australia. Almost every central bank has inflation below its target. There are a few that aren't, but most are below their target, despite unemployment rates being incredibly low. In the United States, the unemployment rate is the lowest in 50 years. In the UK, it's the lowest in 40 years. In Germany, 30 years. In Japan, 30 or 40 years. So, right across the Western world, unemployment rates are the lowest they've been in decades, in maybe half a century. But that's not generating the wage and inflation outcomes. As I said in a speech the other day, when I first started studying economics, I used to write essays about stagflation. High school in the late 1970s, that was high unemployment and high inflation. Now we've got low unemployment and low inflation. It's a much better combination, but we're trying to understand why it is, and I think primarily it's because of these forces of competition coming from globalisation and from technology, because technology increases uncertainty as well. I speak to a lot people in the business community, so they just don't understand what the future technology platforms are going to be. You're nervous about the future, and because of that, you're very careful about your cost base and wage growth.
It's a conversation we were having over lunch, actually, just about the real weight of uncertainty, and even on some of the edges around the pass through of lower interest rates. But the point about every country in the world, most of the developed countries are actually really grappling with the same thing. The Governor and I were talking about a piece of research that the Reserve Bank did last year, which is really trying to understand it, which does draw these links together around technology, and actually trying to look at it on a firm basis rather than economy-wide basis, and the impact of technology and what companies that are investing heavily in technology and who are very competitive are doing in terms of wage growth, profit share, prices in their business versus other companies that are not investing enough to keep themselves competitive. So there's a lot going on at the moment, and it's difficult to understand the totality of this big structural shift, except to say on the balance of risks, the bank clearly now thinks we can push harder.
Yeah, I think that it means the fact that the underlying inflation pressures are less than they used to be means that we can kind of do a bit better on unemployment.
We're on the side of...
Yeah, we can... Because the upside risks on inflation at the moment seem very low to me. Mm. That gives us the opportunity to push to a level of unemployment, which when I started studying economics was conceived kind of dreamland, really. Mm. But I think we can get a significant reduction in unemployment in Australia without having inflation problems. And we're prepared to play a role in that, but we can't do it by ourselves. Mm.
Another question here, thanks.
Andrew Reid from Hender Consulting. I've got the executive labour market in my face every day here in South Australia. As you put up the graphs today, we were feeling that about a year, 18 months ago. So I'm just wondering whether the Reserve Bank's considering how to better get the indicators from the coalface rather than waiting for the proof in the lagging indicator graphs.
We have a very elaborate program to try and get a good read from the coalface, as you say. On your table there, I see our representative here in Adelaide, and he and his team go and talk to people all the time. So if they're not talking to you, I'd encourage you to swap business cards, and I'm sure he'd be very keen to talk to you. We talk across the country at least 100 businesses every month, and that's a really important input into the discussions at the board. At the board, we talk a lot about the ABS data, but we also talk a lot about what we're hearing from the coalface, so please swap business cards with Matt.
But the other thing, Governor, too, is that I used to work in funds management a few years ago, and there was a conventional wisdom in the markets that the bank looked a lot at the rate of change of the unemployment rate. And so the Governor has spoken a lot today about the reflections on the labour market. And some of the data from the labour market are coming through in a very timely manner now. So if you look at job ads that are posted online and trends in job ads for places like SEEK, which is now a collector of a huge amount of data, that information is becoming available really quickly, and you can see movement in that very, very quickly. So I think it's an added thing that I think allows people to get a sense of where the economy is going faster than you would have been able to.
Yeah, so it's a combination. You rely on a combination of the ABS data, which is very extensive, talking to people at the coalface and using the various forms of data that are available from other sources, which we do extensively.
Yeah. Question? Yeah.
Hello. Andrew Marshall. I'm on the TAFE board, but also in the building construction industry. Do you think industrial relations is a big factor that's limiting our labour growth? And what's your view on that? And is there serious reform that's needed, particularly in public sector? I'm in construction building. Some of the EBAs that we see, they're fairly inflexible. Do you think there needs to be a little bit of wholesale reform politically in IR?
Yeah, I'm not sure about that big. By and large, the Australian labour market's done remarkably well. Mm. And I think we went through the biggest resources boom in over a century a little while back, and the economy didn't overheat. We didn't have kind of massive wage explosion. Mm. So the economy dealt with that, and the labour market dealt with that in a fairly stabilising way. Workers were able to move around, and wage increases didn't become excessive. So from that perspective, the labour market's delivered reasonable outcomes, and the unemployment rate being 5% is lower than it's been in a few decades. So from the macro perspective where I sit, the labour market and the industrial relations system has delivered reasonable outcomes. That doesn't mean at the level of individual business we can't have more flexibility, but my perspective really is the macro level, and it's done a pretty good job.
I wonder whether, Governor, one of the issues that we might be needing to reflect on is actually the chart about mobility. And I can join the dots a little bit in terms of some work that we did last year where we asked people about the importance of on-the-job training and reskilling. And the results of our survey showed that older people were just less worried about this. And if you do think about job dislocation and the need to sort of have mobility, I think that the points that you're making about training, not just from an employee's perspective, but also employer's perspective, but also from the employee perspective and how we get that right, but also what the right level of mobility is in terms of productivity and all the rest of it.
Yes, because if you read the newspapers or listen to the radio, I think people have all this job insecurity and young people can't stay at jobs very long, and I've got some teenage children and I tell them, well, I'll have 7 jobs or 15 jobs over there. Lifespan, they've got to be prepared to move around. But despite all that, the reality is people are staying in jobs longer. Mm. I don't understand why that is. Despite all the uncertainty around and all the technology change and structural change in the economy, we're staying in our jobs longer. I think it's kind of linked to this perceptions of uncertainty and competition. Mm. You stay with what you've got in an uncertain world, and people do that. And firms aren't aggressively competing from workers from other firms because they don't want to pay the higher wages that you'd have to do to attract someone. So we're all just kind of staying around a bit longer, and that has some positives because you can build up more firm-specific capital, human capital, but it probably does make the society less dynamic.
Mm. Now, question here.
Governor, thank you very much today. Russell Emerson from People's Choice Credit Union. During the GFC, I'm not equating now to the GFC, the Reserve Bank cut rates by 1% a couple of times to send a very clear signal. Now, given that the cash rate is effectively sending a signal to consumers and business, is the board open, or does it think there's capacity for changes greater than 0.25, or is it we're sort of constrained because there's not really that far to go to zero?
I wouldn't say we're constrained. We basically do what we think is the right thing. In the GFC, there was a kind of a very clear shock. It was very obvious that that the setting of monetary policy need to be recalibrated and recalibrated quickly. And so we took the decision to do that. The current environment's quite different. There has not been a kind of a major adverse shock to the global economy. In fact, I was at the G20 meetings last week in Japan, and the IMF was telling us, well, the global economy could look a bit better next year than it has this year. So there's not a kind of a bad shock that we've got to respond to. As I said before, what we're hoping to do is put us on a better path, and we don't need a massive change in interest rates to do that. I think a moderate change, supported by some measures from Canberra.
We were talking about where rates were around the GFC. We were sort of talking about the trajectory of rates, and just to remind everyone, so the September 2008, which was when the first cut sort of started rolling in, the interest rate was the cash rate was 7.25, and then very quickly was 3% a year later. But it is the governor and I were talking about how it really wasn't that long ago that we were talking about rates that were 7%. And here we are at 1.25. It's quite dramatic, isn't it?
Yep. So it's obvious we can't do multiple cuts of 1% like we do in the GFC. and neither should we be thinking about that either. But, you know, we don't move by 25 basis points because we blink it into kind of only moving by 25 basis points. And we do what we think is the right thing in the circumstances.
Question here. Thank you.
My name's Bill Rungi. I'm here representing myself.
Thanks for coming, Phil.
That's pleasure. It's a great lunch. Cutting interest rates, as you've done, doesn't help savers nor retirees. When you released your last set of minutes, the press poured over them, and I saw a number of reports which said you were concerned about the effect of this, of falling interest rates and the income that retirees were receiving. How serious are you about being concerned about falling interest rates and its effect on retirees and savers? And will you at your next meeting put in a good word for savers and retirees?
Well, at the last meeting I put in a good word for the savers, and I'm reminded of every single day when I turn up in my office there are a pile of letters from savers telling me the difficult circumstances that our decisions have led them to be. And so I'm certainly very conscious of it, and we had a long discussion of it at our last board meeting, and that was reflected in the minutes and the speech that I gave on the day we cut interest rates. So we take it seriously. But it turns out that for every dollar the household sector earn in interest income, they pay $2 in interest. So the household sector is a very substantial net payer of interest to banks. So when we cut interest rates, the household sector in net terms has to pay less interest and has more pockets, more money in its pocket, and spend some of that money, and that helps employment and inflation. So we have to look at the kind of perspective from the economy as a whole, and our judgment remains that lower interest rates will stimulate the economy through improving the cash flow of the household sector and the exchange rate and the other things I talked about before. So it's difficult for the savers, I understand that, but it's the right thing for the overall economy. And if the overall economy is doing better, then in the end we'll all do better. You know, in the meantime, it's very difficult for the savers.
Question here, thank you.
Mike Rangi from the Global Centre for Modern Ageing, and also cousin to the last question that was asked. Governor, thanks for your presentation. 30% of people in their 70s in Sweden are working, and 10% of people in Sweden in their 80s are working. And most of these people working because they like the work rather than necessary primary for the income. I see here you're reporting 20% of males over 65 working, 15% females, so we're quite a way behind Sweden, with an inevitable set of incentives for older people to start working more. Does it make any sense to exclude older people from our participation thinking and into the future? And what's the impact on the things you've presented today on a much larger group of older people working in the future?
Well, it doesn't make any sense to exclude them from our thinking, and we don't do that. And as I showed in one of the graphs, we track the participation rate of older Australians carefully, and it's making a significant contribution to overall participation in the country. I think it's coming around from a couple of things. One is better health outcomes, and the jobs that people are doing, they don't wear out the body like they used to, so people have the potential to work long because their bodies aren't wearing out and the health system's better. So that's positive for the individuals and positive for the society. The changes in the pension arrangements are obviously playing some role as well. And the fact that people's incomes haven't been rising as quickly has probably kept some people in employment longer than they might have wished. So there are kind of a range of factors. We track them quite carefully, and it's having a significant effect on overall labour supply in the country, which is a good thing. So we don't ignore it. No.
Yeah, I think one of the things I would say, if you look at some of the charts that the governor put up, and in particular the decline in the labour force participation rate of men aged 25 to 54, and have a look at some of that relative to some changes in certain industries and sectors, that one of the real challenges is to make sure that we pull people back into employment if they've been dislocated through work. That's why it's so important to get the long-term unemployed back in, because it becomes increasingly difficult. And so if you want people to maintain their labour force participation all the way through life, one of the really important things is to make sure that they don't become disconnected from that at a particular point in time, either because they exit because of a job loss, if it's a female participant, they exit because of child rearing or whatever else, that we have those transitions back. And it underscores the point the governor was making about the ongoing training, the importance of ongoing training to enable that. But to enable the sort of the sustained labour force participation as the economy shifts through technology and the like, it's very, very important. In the past, there's been a real challenge getting older workers back into the workforce, but I think business is getting much better at it now. Question here.
Yes, Jane Durham from Funds SA. I was just interested in the Reserve Bank's thoughts on cryptocurrencies, and in particular the Facebook announcement that's very recent.
Well, I think there's a lot of water to flow under the bridge before Facebook's proposal becomes kind of something that we're using all the time. There are a lot of regulatory issues that need to be addressed, and they've got to make sure that there's a solid business case. So I think we've got to be kind of careful not to jump to conclusions. I have long thought that a kind of a cryptocurrency would not really take off in Australia, because we already have a very, very efficient electronic payment system that allows any one of us to make bank payments to another person in 5 seconds just knowing their mobile phone number. So this is an opportunity for me to advertise the new payments platform, which I hope you all know about, and I hope you all have your pay IDs, and if your bank's not offering it to you, go find one who does. So under that system, we can move money between bank accounts anywhere in the, any two bank accounts in the country within 5 seconds. So it's incredibly flexible. So we at the central bank, we have thought about the case for issuing tokens instead of banknotes. So we could issue kind of electronic versions of Australian dollars, which sit in an app on your phone. Technologically, it's possible. And we could do that rather than issuing pieces of polymer. Mm. But we've made the decision, at least to date, that wasn't in the public interest to do that, because people can already move money around electronically between their bank accounts at no cost, very flexibly. So there wasn't really a strong public policy case for us to issue kind of an electronic token. Didn't see the public case for that. And whether Facebook can do that in a way, we'll have to wait and see.
So I was talking to someone who said they'd written a paper about 25 years ago about how paper money was going to go by the by. But we still have more notes on issue now than we used to. Is that correct?
Well, the stock of currency outstanding relative to the size of the economy is the highest in 50 years.
There you go.
There are 14 $100 notes out there for every person in the country and 28 50s. I don't have my share. I don't know who in this room has theirs.
Can't remember the last time I saw
and
$100
note. Kind of the cash is not being really used for electronic payment payments, but people still hold banknotes for reasons that, you can speculate on. While ever we've got a kind of a first-class domestic payment system that's cheap for people to use and offers great functionality, which our new system does, I see a fairly low probability of that being displaced by some alternative payment system. But it will not charge us too much. It will be replaced. Yeah. But our system, the Australian system, doesn't. We have a really world-class payment system here now.
I'm sitting here glaring in the lights. Yes, I think I'm going to the back of the room here.
Hi, Governor. My name's Megan Dillon with ABC News. Given that the federal government seems very committed to delivering a budget surplus this financial year, what options, other than rate cuts, does the Reserve Bank have to boost the economy?
And does the Reserve Bank have? Well, our main instrument is interest rates, so we don't really have any other options. But public policy has other options. I've long been a very strong advocate for investment in infrastructure. And I think now's the right time to do it. We've got the demand, the capacity in the economy, the labour force that can do that. I mean, it adds to the supply capacity of the economy, so it increases the productive capacity of the economy over time. And there are a range of ways that this can be financed. Right today, the Australian government can borrow at the cheapest rate that it can since we became a federation. I think the 10-year government bond rate's 1.35%, and the government can borrow for almost 30 years at less than 2%. Mm. So there must be some projects out there with risk-adjusted rates of return, 1.5% to 2%. So there's capability to do more investment in infrastructure, provided we choose the right projects and the construction risk is managed well. There's scope to do that while keeping budgets in surplus. The other thing that can be done, which I mentioned at the end of my prepared remarks, is various structural reforms, then the end shouldn't cost that much, that give businesses a greater incentive to invest, hire, expand, employ people. So having a mindset, not just the federal government, but all governments, of creating an environment that encourages businesses, like in this business room, to invest, hire, expand, innovate and employ people. So if that's our mindset, there's no shortage of things that can be done while preserving the budget surplus. And I think we need, as a country, to have a laser-like focus on things that encourage businesses to expand, employ, invest and innovate. And that's not my responsibility. All I do is my board set the overnight interest rate. That's all we can do.
I think that's the governor hand-passing it to everyone in the room.
And it's business, kind of. Yeah. You know, businesses here can employ people, expand, innovate and hire people.
The New South Wales Treasurer has obviously been paying attention to you, Governor, because yesterday in his speech at CEDA, he actually made exactly that point and said that they are borrowing at 1.8%. And they actually have created a generations fund where they're putting money into that fund to be a debt reduction fund in the future, where they're targeting CPI plus 4%. So they're leveraging exactly the differential that you're speaking to.
Yep, I mean, can I just make one other comment? One reason that we have low interest rates in Australia around the world is a lot of people want to save and not many people want to invest. Mm. So when lots of people want to save and not many people want to use the savings to invest, what happens? I'm sorry, the savers get low returns. And it's not the central banks, really. It's the high desire to save around the world relative to invest. If you are an entity that wants to invest, it's fantastic because you can get low funding. Mm. You know, so in Australia, interest rates right across the spectrum are the lowest since Federation this morning. In the last 18 years, you could not borrow cheaper than you can today. So if you want to invest, I hope you've got good ideas. There's plenty of funding there.
On that note, I'm unfortunately going to have to close the Q&A, which has been quite good fun for me, and invite Henry Mintz, the managing partner of South Australia from Deloitte, to deliver the vote of thanks.
Thank you so much. Ladies and gentlemen, good afternoon. It's my pleasure to do the vote of thanks this afternoon. Governor Lowe, on behalf of CEDA, People's Choice, Deloitte, and everybody here this afternoon, thank you so much for addressing us in Adelaide. We really do appreciate it. Your insights you provide on the economy, the not-so-certain rate changes, and our labour force is always fantastically valuable. Thank you for that. Can everybody please join me in thanking Governor Lowe again?